Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, here with
Jeff Rappaport.
And guys, today is pop quiz time. This is the third part in our series, pop quiz. How much do you know about creative financing? So in this series, Jeff has been asking me questions to find out really how much I know about creative financing. And so hopefully you're following along. On our last episode, we ended with the five components of seller financing. So I got, guys, I just want you to answer this right now. What are the five components to any seller financed deal? And so just think about that for a minute. I just wanted to throw that out there because it actually wasn't one of Jeff's questions, but it should have been. And it is now on this show. So the five components is purchase price, interest rate, down payment, term, and a balloon. And the question Jeff asked me, where I didn't get it right, is he said, what is the least important component? And the answer to that was purchase price, because you know, it doesn't matter what you pay for the property as long as you can make the monthly payments work. And that's how the whole deal works, whether you're gonna, you know, hold it as a long-term rental, you know, you got to be able to make money off that, or if you're wholesaling it to an owner occupant or to you know, a landlord, the payment is the most important thing. So least important, purchase price; most important, the two most important is monthly payment and down payment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Either one of those could wreck the deal, right?
Correct.
If the seller wants 25-30% down, that's not necessarily going to work for us. If the payment is too high, and you know, sometimes we can still deal with, you know, you had mentioned interest rate on the last episode, but you know, sometimes interest rate really doesn't matter. You know, we recently did a deal where we did owner financing, and our interest rate was over 7%. But it was on a small amount of money. You know, there wasn't a lot owing on the property, and then the amount still made sense based on, you know, the actual value of the property. So interest rate may or may not be, you know, a huge issue depending on, you know, what that payment is based on what the value is.
Correct.
Good.
Very good.
Okay, so let's jump back into this. I'm having fun here. I don't know about you, because you're on.
Yeah, me too. I am, actually.
Good. So I kind of just answered this question for you, but how much down payment can we pay the seller? And maybe this isn't an exact answer, but what do you think, Jonathan?
Less than 10%.
Definitely less than 10%. I think my answer would be as little as possible, right?
That's a better answer.
Little yep. to no money down would be ideal. And we got to be careful because that's really, if we're wholesaling, isn't that one of our major paydays? That is our payday.
And, yes. Yeah.
If you know, we're offering the seller too much, there's no room to get us paid as well.
Right.
Okay. All right, so when wholesaling a creative financing deal, how do we add our assignment fee?
So that we just mark up the purchase price, and that's how we wholesale it. So if you know, if we're buying a property for $100,000 and we're looking for, you know, and say we're offering $10,000 to the seller, and we want a $15,000 wholesale fee, we're going to ask for $25,000 down.
And so we're adding sell the property. So we're adding it to both the purchase price and the down payment.
Correct. Yeah. So we're marking the property up to 100 and we're selling it for 125 and asking for 25 down. And then we give 10 to the seller and keep 15 for ourselves.
Okay. When we're looking at structuring a deal, and this probably is not going to come across very good for you, but think about a lot of the conversations that the two of us have had. When looking at structuring a deal, what do I try to determine first?
When structuring a deal, what do you try to determine?
Me personally. So numerous times we've talked about, first and foremost, what am I trying to identify right off the bat?
Oh, you're trying to identify what the monthly payment can be.
No. Although that is still a good.
You're trying to identify whether what your exit strategy is, if you're going to sell it to an owner occupant.
So I'm trying to determine my buyer, right?
Yeah, your buyer. Yeah.
Yeah. And let's talk about the different buyers.
Okay. Let's do that. So different buyers, if you're asking me the question,
I am.
You got a owner occupant, which is someone that will live in the property and, you know, use it as their own home. You have a landlord who's going to use it as a rental property. I guess owner occupant and retail buyer is kind of the same, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking of like retailing as a exit strategy.
Well, we have wholesale and
wholetailing, retail, right? Yeah, wholetailing to a retail buyer, right?
Yeah.
I think that's it. Is that
one more?
Yourself holding it.
Well, what about like to a rehabber possibly?
Oh yeah, to a rehabber.
So isn't that one of the things that we first try to identify is, you know, who is our potential buyer? You know, there may not be enough equity in a property that would, you know, make it so a rehabber would be interested. We can get, typically when our deal is really tight, where we're paying, you know, close to market value or market value. Really the only thing that we've been able to negotiate is a decent down payment. We're willing to pay a decent payment, decent purchase price. That's most likely going to be an owner occupant. They typically pay the most, but you know, the down payment's got to be right or else they won't be in either. Landlords pay probably the second most. But the cash flow's got to make sense. Their cash on cash return has got to make sense. And yes. And then the rehabbers would, and then wholesale retail, which is where we maybe can't buy it for what we would want as a wholesale price, but it still might make sense to buy it and then put it right back on the market, doing little to no work to it.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Landlord.
All right. So when we're looking at wholesaling a rental property, what do we want to analyze to see if there's enough cash flow? How do we want to deal with the process of analyzing this deal to see if it see how we can structure it if we can at all.
Repeat the question.
So when we're looking at dealing with a rental property,
okay,
and we're trying to structure offers, how do we analyze this deal? What is the one thing that I like to do to try to see if there's enough cash flow to deal with this property?
So you have to determine, first thing you have to know is market rent. So you got to determine what the market rent is in that area. And then you can, you know, and then from that market rent, from that, we know what we try to set up what we need the payment to be.
So we work backwards, right? We take into account, we figure out what the absolute market rents would be or could be, and take into account all of the expenses, and then the debt service, and then what we could pay the seller and what we could still leave over for us or our buyer.
Correct.
Right. So working backwards, which we have done many times on many of our episodes.
All right. We always do. We always work backwards.
Yeah. But what equation are we looking for to determine if we have a good deal to offer to a landlord?
Oh, we're looking for we're looking to see if we can produce a 10 to 12% cash on cash return for them.
Okay, at least, right? I mean,
yeah. that at minimum, be. Yeah, probably. Is your minimum 10, Jeff, or do you? I know you talk about 12% a lot. That's your kind of.
Mostly, my minimum is 12 plus, but sometimes I can get away with a little lower cash on cash return if our term is longer, or you know, you have like principal only payments or something that really entices someone to be interested in the deal. If it's, you know, just a 3 or 5 year balloon, then yeah, I think I'd want it to be 12 plus.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. How do you respond to questions or objections from the seller?
How do you respond with a question? You respond to seller. If they ask a question, you respond with a question.
That's right.
And if they bring up an objection, you repeat the objection back to them so that they know you're listening, and then you address it.
This was on one of our more recent
negotiations
episodes, right?
Yep.
You want to give an example?
If the seller says, "Well, I'm afraid to transfer my property to you via seller financing because I'm afraid of the due on sell clause," you would say something like, "Well, I understand that you're afraid of the due on sell clause, but the reality is banks rarely do this. And there's some steps that we can take on our end so that we don't notify the bank of the transaction."
And maybe even a better way would be is tell me what are your concerns? And are those concerns something that's going to keep you up at night? Before we start trying to answer what we believe to be his concern, his or her concern, we are trying to make sure that we identify exactly what the concern is.
Right.
And then we could potentially mirror that, you know, verify that we're, so if I'm understanding you correctly, that, you know, you're telling me that having that due on sale clause possibility out there may keep you up at night and may cause you enough stress and anxiety that maybe this is not a good situation. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah. I love it.
So we always want to use questions and kind of rephrasing in terms of, it's almost like you don't even negotiate anymore. It's, you just keep asking questions until you get where you want to go.
Okay. Yeah. So how to handle seller objections. You ask what really is the most important thing to them, or why, what their concerns are specifically.
Okay. All right. So this question comes up a lot, and we've certainly answered it, but, and you've actually answered it on, you know, I think it was last episode, but I want to touch on this again. What are two different ways you can handle homeowners insurance?
What are two different ways you can handle homeowners insurance? You get an additional policy in place. And then you can ask to be named as an additional insured on an existing policy.
Okay.
Does that answer it?
Yeah. And so let's dive a little deeper, because I know people, I just saw someone ask this on our Facebook page in the last day or two. So I view insurance as having one of three options. Okay. One option is I'm going to get a whole separate policy. I'm going to leave the existing policy in place. And, you know, we're going to continue to make payments on it. So there's going to be two insurance policies out there. Okay. This only makes sense is if you have had a discussion with your insurance provider and that provider has said, based on, you know, what we've set up, if there was a fire or some kind of accident, that you would be covered. If you are not covered, this is not an option. Now it's just a liability expense that you're paying extra for that's not covering you. So, I would never it's certainly the easiest way to go is just to get a second policy, but you got to know whether it covers you or not. And there are insurance providers that, if you don't own this property, you can't have insurance against it. So, right. You got to be careful. You got to explain what your situation is, how you're involved in this property, and see if you would be covered. So, okay, that to me is an easy one. If you're not covered, it's out. You're not doing that, right?
Right.
The second would be that you just have the seller add you as additionally insured.
Yeah, so be
fairly simple. However, you need to know this, that if there was a fire, the bank is going to get, the bank is still listed as loss payee, so they get paid first on, whatever they're owed. And then a check for the balance would come in your name and the seller's name. And unless you have a limited power of attorney that allows you to deal with that, or permission, or a relationship with the seller where it's not going to be a problem, you're going to need that seller's permission to cash that check. So there may be some ways that you want to set that up. The one that comes to mind for me is that limited power of attorney.
Okay.
The third way. Okay. And this may be the best way, but it may be the most complicated. And that would be that you are going to get a brand new policy on the property. You are going to name the bank as loss payee, just like they are on the previous policy. And in this case, you are going to be the primary insured and the seller will be added as additionally insured. That way you have the most current and updated policy, but the bank will be notified that there's a change in insurance. However, what's the change really? The change is the bank is still loss payee. You may be showing that it's a different entity. That's some of the risks that you run with doing this. Does it mean anything? It may not. So these are the three different ways that you can utilize. You choose which one you think is in your best interest, but just make sure that at the end of the day that you're covered, because you don't want to do one and not have any coverage.
Yeah. So you get a second insurance policy. You ask to be added to added as additional insured on the current policy, or you get a new policy with the bank as loss payee and seller as additional insured.
You as primary insured.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Write that down. Yep. Cool. All right.
Just a couple more. What due diligence items do you want from the seller when doing an owner finance deal?
Due diligence items. A mortgage statement. And I guess you'd want to see proof of insurance, of property insurance, if you can. I don't know. I think a mortgage statement, property insurance. I feel like I'm missing something.
Well, a couple things. And maybe I should have stated this in a little different way, but due diligence items is you want to see the most recent mortgage statement, obviously, with interest rate, principal and interest balance. If there's a balloon payment, anything like that, it would be ideal to get a copy of the note, but that may or may not happen. And then obviously what we want to collect, and maybe I'll just add this as a separate question, is that so we definitely want those things. And depending on the situation, we may need, you know, if they were behind on payments or whatever, we may need a reinstatement, we may need a payoff. We may need, depending on, you know, title issues, we may need information on different lien holders, judgment holders, whatever. So, but yes, mortgage statement and or note would be the two things that we are after right up front. Okay. What documentation do we want signed by our seller? What are some of the things that we'd want signed by our seller that maybe we don't need on a traditional sale?
So like limited power of attorney I don't know what the banks call it, like an authorization, giving us authorization to
authorization to release. Yep.
Authorization to release. That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. So maybe a limited power of attorney and authorization to release.
Yep.
Am I missing something?
You may want a CYA letter, cover your assets. now, so if you were taking a property subject to, or you know, there's a due on sale clause that you're making it clear to the seller that, you know, that this could happen and, you know, you've been made aware. You could have what's called seller acknowledgments, which are, you know, basically questions that they answer that they say that they're been made aware of what's going on and how it's going to happen and, you know, how long it's going to go on for. You may want what's called an escrow letter. You know, if there's an escrow account that's been set up that includes the taxes and insurance, you're basically taking over that escrow account. And you don't really want at the end of the term, if there's any money left in that escrow account, that it gets sent back to the homeowner, the person on the loan.
Yeah.
And so you can submit this letter. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it basically says just take the escrow amount and apply it toward the principal balance. So that way you actually get credit for it rather than the homeowner or the previous homeowner. So there's probably also a clause that you would want added to, you know, if you were buying this property, you're not wholesaling it, right? So you're going to either be the buyer or you're going to be in the middle. Is you want first right of refusal to buy this note if the seller decides to sell the note at some point in the future. You may want to have a clause in there about substitution of collateral, depending on the term of your that you agree to. So there's a number of things that you may want. And, you know, as you do more of these, you know, it would be worthwhile to spend 45 minutes to an hour with an attorney that's well-versed in creative financing to just get them to write up the different types of documents that you want in every transaction.
Yeah. So just to summarize, it was an authorization to release mortgage info, letter to apply escrow balance to principal.
Yes. It's just called an escrow letter.
Escrow letter. Escrow letter. I'm just putting this in the notes here. Escrow letter, and then limited power of attorney for insurance payout.
Yep.
And then what else?
Seller acknowledgement. And the seller acknowledgement might be seller understands that loan will be left in his or her name for the next 10 years and bank may call loan due.
Yeah.
Something to that effect. Seller understands that buyer will be making up arrearage of up to $30,000 at time of closing, and seller will receive, $10,000 in addition to that. These became popular, after the last crash, especially when you were dealing with elderly, military, people like that, where you better be careful with what you're proposing to them and what they're agreeing to, and being very clear that they understand.
Okay. Cool.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a choice, Jonathan. I think that we're out of time on this. We could just call it a good, or we still have questions. We might want to do one more. It'll be up to you.
Did we cover all the questions on the quiz?
No.
Okay.
But we still have some.
Yeah, so I say let's do another one.
Okay.
Yeah, so guys, there will be a part 4 of Pop Quiz. So hope you're learning a lot here. This is really a broad overview of seller financing, the different components, the things you need to think about, how to make money, how to protect yourself, how to protect your seller, kind of all of that. So this is going to be a really, really good series for you guys to learn, whether you're new or whether you've been using creative financing. We've gone over so much in this. I think you told me that at the beginning, Jeff, it's going to be a broad overview, which it really is, which is,
yeah.
It's been great. I think, especially for me, because like things I'm taking notes of right now is like, if you were to ask, I didn't really know the last question you answered, what additional docs do we need signed by our seller? I didn't have all of that. I wrote down limited power of attorney for insurance payout, the escrow letter. I didn't even know that. Yeah. I've done a transaction where the escrow balance went back to the seller because I didn't have a escrow letter in place when we did a subject 2.
Well, I'll tell you the one that, the escrow letter is hit and miss. It's certainly worthwhile. The seller will always sign it. It's not a big deal. The one that you really want is if you've created, somewhat of a longer term owner financing deal. the chances of the seller playing it out to the end are very, very small. At some point, they're going to be looking for money to cash this out or cash out a partial. And you want that first opportunity because, you know, having a $300,000 note's fine on the day of closing, but 3 months, 6 months, a year from then, they might need more cash. And every time that they need more cash is an opportunity for you.
Right. So first right of refusal to buy note.
Yep.
Okay. Sweet. All right, guys. You know where to reach us, the creativefinancingpodcast.com. That's where all of our episodes are. We're at Facebook at the Creative Financing Podcast. If you guys are working on a deal and you need some directions, please leave the information there on our page so that our community can help you as well as us. If you're interested in Jeff's apprenticeship program, please email Rebecca, and that's R-E-B-E-C-C-A, at weofferoptions.com. She'll get you the needed information for his apprenticeship. If you guys have not gotten our video already, the step-by-step video on how to structure creative financing terms, you need that. You need to get that because it's, you know, it'll definitely help you learn this. And you can get that by texting CFP or creative financing to 877-409-8090. And then if you're interested in our Creative Financing Academy, which we are currently working on, and we'll let you know when that's available. But if you're interested in that and you want to be first on our list to get that, hit us up. Let us know that you're interested in that as well, because we'll be going back through, you know, all of our text messages and voicemails to see who's interested in that, and they're going to be the first to get it. Anything I missed, Jeff?
Nope. Remember, I'm looking to literally double, maybe triple my apprentice program. The apprentice program focuses on wholesaling with a creative financing element. We work nationwide, and we work in the commercial realm as well. It'll be a great education for you. You're actually doing while you're learning. And we want to help people that really want to make a difference in their lives now. The Creative Financing Academy is strictly all creative financing. It is literally just like that video that we're offering. If you have not checked that out, you need to. Everyone has loved that. And join our Facebook group and be a part. Ask your questions. We can get to them a lot faster in the Facebook group.
Yeah. And last thing, please remember to rate and review us, guys. This is this really helps us get on the radar of Apple Podcasts and the other big podcast hosts, so that we can continue to grow this, because this is really a labor of love from Jeff and I, this podcast, and a lot of work goes into it behind the scenes. So we would greatly appreciate your feedback for you to just take the time to rate and review us. Okay, guys, till next time, go out there and create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.